Okay, well, you've been speaking for quite a while, Dr. Ricketts, but I would like to ask you one last question. If we come back to the United States and look at the really serious crisis that we're facing in terms of the prisons today, what aspects of the experience that you saw in this one cell that you were in China, do you think that can be usefully, can any of this be usefully incorporated into our current system as an alternative to the way prisons are now run?
Well, actually, in some prisons, you know, they've tried group therapy. They have group therapy sessions. They have alternatives to violence sessions and things of that kind. And some of them do have constructive results. The problem is basically, however, twofold as I see it. The most important thing is that, as I said, there's no such thing as real reform. You can have the best of intentions, but when you come out, and if you're thrown back into the same environment as you were before, as what happens in American prison system, you probably have acquired skills at being a criminal that you never had before when you went in there. You certainly can come away with a tremendous amount of bitterness towards society as a whole, a destructive bitterness, not a constructive one, and are thrown back into joblessness and the whole mess that you were before. One of the most successful things that I've seen is a prison in New York, and it's successful primarily because the wives, in order to get close to their husbands, moved up to the prison and got jobs around there while their husbands were in jail. And then when their husbands came out, the husbands settled there too. And the rate of recidivism is very low in that group because, you know, they're no longer thrown back into that same kind of environment that they had before. So unless the society provides a decent environment for people to return to punishment in itself is hopeless, because that doesn't do the thing. And furthermore, even positive techniques administered by the most well-intended people are not going to have any kind of effect. The other thing about it is, you know, a number of years ago, there was a book published by Eric Frome called The Sane Society, in which it's, you know, said categorically, you know, how can you talk about making people sane when they live in an insane society in which the motivations, the, you know, everything is reduced to such a base level. So what are you reforming people to do? You reform somebody to become, instead of being a con artist to become a used car salesman? I mean, I'm not condemning all used car salesmen, but, you know, in the traditional sort of sense. Is this what we're supposed to be doing? Well, of course, that in some ways is a minor problem. At least the used car salesman doesn't hit people on the head or, you know, that sort of a thing. But the basic problem, that unless we're willing, we can create a society in which the environment for people to return to is a constructive environment, there's no way that we can deal with this problem of recurring crime.
And if people are interested in reading more about some of the details of all this that you've been speaking about, I believe you have a book, and maybe you could just give us the title in case someone wants to look it up.
Well, the book is called Prisoners of Liberation. There were three different editions of it. Unfortunately, it is currently out of print, although I understand one group here has Xeroxed it and has some copies available. But that's the book about it.
Thank you, Dr. Alan Ricketts. Yeah, so I was just realizing that one of the things I really should have asked you was this issue about if this was a technique that was used for all kinds of prisoners, not just people that were, say, accused of treason, people that we might consider violent criminals. So could you address that?
Yeah. Now, you know, this system of criticism and self-criticism didn't originate with the Chinese. Actually, the Russian communists, or the Soviet communists, had used it within the party. But in China, it was used on a much broader basis. And it was introduced in China, as far as I've been able to find out, back in the late 1920s. At that time, the Chinese communists had been pushed up into the hills and were living in a very restricted area as guerrillas. And Mao at that time made the statement that the guerrillas are like a fish in the water. The people are the water, the guerrillas are the fish. And unless the people support the guerrillas, like the water supports the fish, they have no hope. Well, it became absolutely mandatory that the guerrillas be compatible with the people, that they really work with the people. Now, unfortunately, in traditional China, armies always lived off the land. It didn't matter whether they called themselves revolutionary or whether they called themselves monarchist or whatever they were. That was the tradition for armies, and they took whatever they wanted. If they wanted grain, they took grain. If they wanted women, they took women, whatever was there. And the troops that came into the Chinese communists were largely warlord troops that had defected and gone over to the communists, or rough peasant lads, you know, who had been through that kind of a situation. So what happened was that they, in order to create troops that could work with the people, they did two things. One, they introduced an iron discipline. And in fact, the Liberation Army song is called 8 Points of Discipline. And it was a discipline that was so rigid that you could be shot for borrowing a needle and not returning it. Now, that didn't always happen. That didn't happen. But punishment for, you know, taking things from peasants and that sort of thing did occur enough so that the troops realized that it meant business. The other thing was that they introduced the beginnings of thought reform there. And the way they would do it was they'd get a group of these soldiers sitting down, and they'd get them to talking about some of the terrible things that had happened to them or to their families and so on. Well, these were all soldiers came from the lowest strata of the society, traditionally in China. You know, they used to be said that good iron isn't made into nails, good men are not made into soldiers. You know, this was a traditional thing. So these were people who were in the army largely because they were fleeing from starvation or had been conscripted, or, and they had all been beaten, and they, you know, terrible things had happened to them. They'd seen their women raped, and they'd seen their people starve and what have you. So they got to talking about it, and they got, you know, they would get terribly worked up, emotional about these things. They'd be crying and so on. And then they would hand it to them. They'd say, now, this is how you feel when these things have happened to you. How do you think other people feel when you've done the same thing to them? Now, let's talk about what you did. Well, they'd all done something. The least they would have done was steal somebody's chicken, which may not seem like a big deal unless it happens to be your chicken, unless your livelihood depends upon that chicken.
Or your kids are hungry.
Your kids are hungry and so on. So they would get them talking about that. And they would also get worked up over this, you know, very emotional about it, you know, beating their breasts and saying, how could I have done this sort of thing? And then they would say to him, now look, you cannot avoid the responsibility for your own actions. But this is the way the old society was. What we're going to do is build a new society. And then you begin to get, you know, the gradual introduction of Marxism, Leninism into these discussions about what the goals of the new society is, what communism means and socialism means and that sort of thing. And so it was tremendously effective. I talked earlier about this sort of Boy Scout attitude of these troops. That's how it began. That's how it was. That's how these kids really began to believe and to behave in accordance with these beliefs. This was the new society, and they should treasure it and protect it. So that was this form. Right after the revolution, when communists first came in, they didn't use criticism and self-criticism on a broad scale. Primarily at that time, what we were doing is simply trying to get things organized because the country was in such terrible straits. And in the university where I was, we had to form committees to run this, to run that. We had, and we sat down as a faculty to work out our salaries. There were terrible inequities in housing, and we had committees for that. The women began to organize for nursery schools and, you know, care centers, and they began to have cooking classes and choruses, and they had, oh, just tremendous things, you know, that were going on. Everybody was involved. The students had to run their own dormitories, had to run their own cafeterias, they had to have food committees and so on, and so everybody got in discussion. People also wanted to know what Marxism and Leninism was all about, because nobody knew anything, so you had to have discussion groups based around that. One of my friends, who was an authority on Six Dynasties Buddhism, I was asked to do the lectures on dialectical materialism. He had no idea what dialectical materialism was. So he had, you know, really had to study. And so, and then they criticized the Dickens out of him because of what mistakes he had made and so on. But it was all part of this process, not necessarily of criticism and self-criticism, but of developing a socialness, a social awareness, a feeling of being in groups and working with people. Well, when the Korean War broke out, and then particularly when the Chinese Communists went in, and of course there was tremendous upsurge of patriotism and so on, and this then became the basis for a lot of criticism and self-criticism. Because one of the things that was very evident in the university was this sort of slavish attitude toward American culture. Most of the professors wore American tweed jackets, dressed in, you know, Western fashion with tweed jackets, smoked a pipe, spoke English all the time, or even if they spoke Chinese, was interlarded with so much English and French or whatever to show off. When they published articles, they were always in English. If they published anything in Chinese, they felt it was very déclassé. And this whole series of attitudes, and those came under criticism then. In this patriotic movement. And I've seen professors, you know, distinguished professors in tears, you know, about how they loved Sherlock Holmes, you know, and detective stories and so on. Well, the problem wasn't whether they liked detective stories or not. The problem was this whole complex of attitudes and outlooks that tended to view what happened in the United States as far superior to anything that was Chinese, and to overcome that. And from then, of course, the whole thing. So that the whole society was going through a very similar sort of thing. In the factory, if you went to work at 6:30 or 7 in the morning, what you would do is you'd spend maybe a half an hour in exercises, as they became very strong in physical education. Then you would spend an hour in criticism and self-criticism. Or it was called study. It wasn't called criticism and self-criticism, because a lot of that had to do with studying what the government's policies were. But then you had talked about how you felt about those, whether, you know, and the same sort of things that we did. So the whole society was moving along that way. Well, in terms of prisoners who were hadn't committed violent crimes, but had committed crimes, several things could happen. One of them was that one punishment was to, well, first place, crimes that involved less than a 3-year sentence were considered to be non-criminal crimes. And those crimes could be treated, if they were relatively mild crimes, and it looked like the person could reform. This is particularly true of young people. They would be allowed to stay in their community, but placed under surveillance by the community. That is, the community leader, the block groups, street groups, street committees could call them in for questioning at any time. They had to account for their time, things of this kind. They had to do local labor like sweeping streets and things of that kind. And then they abolished that because they said crime work should never be a punishment. Work was an honor, not a punishment. And so people were encouraged to work because then that showed that you were reforming, which, in a curious way, was almost the same, but did cast things in a different light. And so that was the mildest. Then people could be sent to reform through labor camps. And the idea there was to do, it was twofold. One was a mild punishment, or not so mild, but a punishment. But it was coupled with an education and teaching people skills, but even more important, attitude toward work and work ethic and work attitude. A person who had been in our prison and had gone out to work on a prison farm was brought back to the prison because his, where we were, because his case had come up again. And so he told us about what happened in the farm that he was sent to. This was a big farm, prison farm, outside of Tinsin, and it had been set up on salt flats that had originally been too salty, too alkaline to really farm. So they, this was about two or three years after the farm had been started. The soil had been leached, so now it was a going farm. That was when it was really tough working out there, was leaching that soil. But when he went out, they were in barracks. They lived in barracks. And he was made part of a group. And he was told that their group would be given an assignment, a work assignment. But before they went out to work, they would establish their own quota of what they felt their group could do in terms of work each day. And the work assignment they received was to weed. Now, before they even got to discussing the quota, they were asked to discuss weeding, how you weeded or wed or whatever, and how you why it was important and so on. And this discussion went on for a long period of time. Until they had gotten to the point where they knew, not only knew what they were supposed to do, but they had come to at least say that this weeding was extremely important, that the whole future of China and the new China depended upon it, you know, because of, anyway. Then they discussed the quota. Well, this took endless hours because they didn't want to, if they cut it too low, well, they were told also that if they made their quota, they would be given a small financial reward. And, of course, if they consistently met their quota, this meant that their work attitude was good and this would help toward getting their sentence reduced. So it was very important for them to make this quota. So then they discussed the quota. Well, they didn't want to set it too low because then that wouldn't show good. But if they set it too high, they wouldn't make the quota. So this was a very difficult problem. Anyway, they finally set their own quota, and then they went out to weed. Well, of course, they found that the correct way to weed is, you know, you carefully get the roots and the stems. But they also found this was rather slow, and along about mid-morning, they would look up and see all that they had left to do. So they gradually start picking up the speed, and that meant, of course, just getting it. Pretty soon, they were just taking the tops off the weeds as they went along. Then when they got back to the barracks tonight at night, they found that the topic of conversation was, why was it that instead of weeding the way you were supposed to, the way you knew that you were supposed to, you just went along and took off the tops? And, of course, there was only one answer, that you didn't give a damn about those, about weeding, about doing the work. All you cared about was getting that reward and making the quota. Well, this was what the lesson was. The lesson was that if you thought of, if you worked for the work itself, concentrated on doing the work itself, you'd make your quota eventually. Maybe not at first, but eventually you would. You'd get more skillful at it, you'd do a better job of it. But that if you thought about, if you were primarily interested in that reward, you were going to cheat. And if you cheated, you were going to get caught, and the whole thing was a shambles. So this was what was a lesson that had to be drilled in time and time and time and time again. That is, doing the work for the thing itself. And I found that, you know, extremely interesting when I got to the university, both as a student and then when I began teaching. You can, you know, like cheating on a footnote, which, you know, students do all over the place, including people who do dissertations. And the thing about it was that I'd had enough exposure that I just never could do it. I just never felt comfortable. I could get away with it. It wasn't a question of not being able to get away with it. But it was just that not looking something up, taking somebody else's footnote and accepting that as right without looking it up, the text up. Well, 95% of the time is perfectly all right. The other 5% of the time, nobody's going to catch it anyway. But I just never could feel comfortable about doing that, having gone through this experience in China. And plus, my professor was, that was his view, that you just didn't do that sort of thing. And I think that is, you know, as I say, reform isn't a question of deciding, you know, I want to do good. That isn't reform. Reform is doing good because you don't think about doing something else. That's when it becomes reform.